Hello and welcome to a very special episode of The Laydown. My name is Ryan, and today I am thrilled to share my interview with Alex E. Harrow. Alex E. Harrow is a Hugo Award-winning American science fiction and fantasy writer. Her novel, The 10,000 Doors of January, was one of my favorite books last year, and her new novel, The Once and Future Witches, is scheduled to be released on October 13th of this year, and it is phenomenal. Listen to the synopsis. In the late 1800s, three sisters use witchcraft to change the course of history in this powerful novel of magic and the suffragette movement. In 1893, there's no such thing as witches. There used to be, in the wild, dark days before the burnings began, but now witching is nothing more than tidy charms and nursery rhymes. If the modern woman wants any measure of power, she must find it at the ballot box. But when the Eastwood sisters, James Juniper, Agnes Amaranth, and Beatrice Belladonna, join the suffragists of New Salem, they begin to pursue the forgotten words and ways that might turn the women's movement into the witches' movement. Stalked by shadows and sickness, hunted by forces who will not suffer a witch to vote, and perhaps not even to live, the sisters will need to delve into the oldest magics, draw new alliances, and heal the bond between them if they want to survive. There's no such thing as witches, but there will be. How good does that sound? I had the opportunity a couple of weeks ago to sit down remotely and chat with Alex E. Harrow, and I am so excited to share that interview with you now. Please enjoy. So hi, Alex. How are ya?
I'm pretty good. You know, as that's a loaded question these days, but I'm doing fine.
Hanging in there. At the, you know, gestures vaguely, like, we're all doing our best. So I just want to kind of jump in a little bit with some background. So did you always want to be an author?
I think the honest answer is yes, but I was a huge chicken. So like, I think when I was like, if you'd asked me when I was like 12, I'd be like, absolutely, I want to be an author because 12-year-olds are very brave and know what they're about. But if you'd asked me when I was 19, I would have been like, no, I think I'm going to be an academic, maybe. I don't make plans. So yes is the answer, but it took me until I was like 25 to actually admit it again as an adult.
Yeah, that makes sense. I get that. So your books have this really great Southern Gothic vibe to them, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that and where that comes from.
Yeah, so what's funny is until recently I wouldn't have even identified that in my own writing. I just had this like thing where Kentucky showed up no matter what I wrote. Yeah. I was like, that's fine, that's just a habit. I won't become one of those insane authors like Stephen King who sets everything in a small town in Maine. I'm not like obsessive or anything. But I think it's one of those things where that advice, you know, to write what you know, I always a little bit laughed at it because I'm like writing fantasy books and I'm like, I get to make stuff up. But the truth is that you do, like a lot of your writing is more honest than you think it is.
Yeah.
And it turns out what I honestly know is like both sides of my family are from Kentucky way, way, way back. And I grew up here and I'm raising kids in small town Kentucky. And so it's just sort of infiltrated everything. And only recently have I started to treat that like, I don't know, like a specific cultural background rather than like a default. You know, it just seems like, oh, but that's just, you know, like middle white America. There's nothing particular about that. But there's all the specificity that has to do with time and geography and history. And so I've been like reading Southern and particularly Kentuckian literature with like more attention lately, which sounds pretentious, but what it has resulted in is building a Twitter bot with my brother that spits out Southern Gothic lines.
It's my favorite thing.
Which I love very, very much.
Oh, it's so good. I retweet that bot like 4 times a day. It's so good.
I'm so proud. My brother was like, dude, I thought this was going to be like a 2-hour project. And I was like, you don't understand.
What was the process of building that? Because I know he did like the tech stuff, but like, yeah. Did you write the phrases or is it sort of, does it pull random like word? Like,
oh, it pulls random words. So like,
okay.
He explained to me what sort of a bot he could make, which is basically like, I needed to write both parts of a Mad Libs thing. So I like made all these sentences where like the adjectives and nouns and places and characters are all in brackets. So I just built a little Excel spreadsheet with all these great Southern sounding adjectives and like names in one column. It's so fun. I just want to keep messing with it. And I think everyone should build bots now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm obsessed with it. It's so great. It's going to make for so many amazing writing prompts. So good. There was one yesterday about like the vines being lonely. And I was like, yes. Oh my God. So good. So you have degrees in history, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how does that play into your writing? Because again, you've got like the Southern Gothic thing, but there's some history in your books. There's some aspects of that.
Yeah. I think I always want to set things in the past.
Yeah.
Even though I'm currently writing contemporary stuff, because you have this illusion, or at least I have this illusion when I write things in the past, that you can like understand the sociocultural setting in a complete way, which is a total illusion. You absolutely can't. But like there's a limited number of sources and you get to build a very specific aesthetic and image. Whereas like writing in the contemporary world, you feel the messiness and diversity and complexity of the world in a much more intimidating way to me. But also having history degrees did, I think, teach me how to write, because like I said, I was too chicken to actually take creative writing classes. So I just had long history papers, and it turns out they're not all that dissimilar really. Like academic writing takes a lot of organization and some creativity, and you're basically like weaving a narrative out of found evidence and objects, you know, and it's not as far apart as people think.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. Yeah, I never really thought about it that way. I was such an English major that I was like...
Many people I talk to now are the English major people, and I almost envy them, because I saw y'all in college and I was like, no, I'm a serious academic, I'm going to study history. But it's like, why? Like, I took lit classes for my electives. What was I doing?
But history is important too. We need the history majors. Need them. Switching gears a little bit, talking about sort of like fairy tales and magic and things like that. So both of your books thus far, there's this theme of like words and stories having this immense power. I wonder if you could talk about the power of words and stories either in your own life or in the world at large or both.
Yeah. So this is something that I find personally embarrassing, but I can't help, because like now that I'm officially a writer, I am aware how egotistical it is to constantly be like slamming my fist down on the table and say like, stories are important. You know what makes us human? Our storytelling. But here I am doing that in everything that I write. I understand that it's annoying, but it works on me so, so well. It's something that I like fundamentally believe, so that even like if any character in any book or show says like, it's the stories that matter, I immediately tear up, even if it's not earned at all. Like in Game of Thrones, which in its terrible finale, at some point, Tyrion just all of a sudden is like, you know what binds us together? Stories. And I'm like, that is not earned. That has not been proven in any part of this million year show. And I'm here for it, Tyrion. Tell me more. Yep. That's who I am as a person.
Totally.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think as silly as that is, I also just like genuinely think that's true. Like what we're doing in academic history is trying to tell the story about ourselves, right? Like we're trying to make sense of who we are. And I think narrative and identity are just so closely tied together, both on a personal level and on like a cultural, socio-political level. So I am both embarrassed and legitimately obsessed with that.
No, I'm fully obsessed with it. I'm with you. It's true. There's a type of real life magic in, you know, words and stories and oral histories and things like that. It's there's definitely power in that. So fairy tales play a really, really huge role in your new book, The Once and Future Witches, which is amazing. And I'm obsessed with it. do you have a favorite fairy tale?
I don't really. I mean, like I was a little girl in the 90s. So I was like, I imprinted pretty hard on Disney's particular collection of princess fairy tales. I'm not going to lie, but I also had like a mom who was an English major. So I had a lot of like fairy tale collections and stuff like that, and world mythologies. And I think I was one of the few kids that like had their mom read a version of the Ballad of Mulan before the Disney movie came out.
Nice.
Because it's a second generation nerd situation is what I have. But I think if I had a personal favorite, it's probably the variations of the Seven Swans, the one where the girl has to save her brothers and like she's all noble and has to like knit them shirts, because I have two younger brothers and I like to think that I was like that kind of very self-sacrificing sister. I'm absolutely not. I really like that idea.
That's awesome. I love that. Yeah, I also grew up very firmly in like the Disney fairy tales. And then it wasn't until I think college I got a really nice copy of the Grimm fairy tales. And I was like, oh, wait, hold on. I was like, this is awesome. I have been missing out. Like,
and
I knew.
Also terrible. Like,
yeah, I mean, also terrible. But yeah, way, way more fun for me.
Just for the record, I got to write a novella for Tor that's coming out that is like all the different versions of Sleeping Beauty. Like, so like it's like a folklore student who knows all the different versions getting sucked into the Disney version of the story. It's so indulgent. It was ridiculous to write, and I had so much fun.
Oh, I'm so excited to read that. That's going to be amazing. So did you have to do some like research into fairy tales when you were writing Once and Future Witches?
One of the things I tried to limit in writing this book, partly because it was the first book that I had written on a 1-year deadline, was the amount of research that I let myself get sucked into. And I told myself, like, because it's infinite, the amount of research you can put into any novel, regardless of whether it's historical or not. I truly believe, like, you can just sink yourself into research, which is not that productive always. Mm-mm. So I told myself early on that this was an alternate world, and that what I needed to spend time on was building the world I was trying to write rather than trying to bury really clever Easter eggs. Now, I did still do that way too much. But like, I tried hard to like ask myself, not like, what are all the pre-existing versions of like Sleeping Beauty, the story mm-hmm. that's in there rewritten, but like, what would the version they tell in this world be, and to mm-hmm. just kind of more freely make it up. Mm-hmm. Now, where I did do research for the fairy tales was there's a couple in there that aren't Western, as mm-hmm. like, you know, the sisters encounter, you know, people who aren't white girls from Kentucky.
Right.
They sort of increase their mythology of witches, and those took a lot more research because I didn't want to accidentally steal stories from other cultures that had significance that I didn't understand. Mm-hmm. So like, there's one that is told by a woman who has like Black Southern heritage, and that one isn't a specific story. It's like a combination of like maybe 8, including mm-hmm. like it's an Aunt Nancy story, because I thought Aunt Nancy as a Americanized version of Anansi, the spider storytelling god, you know, would like
so
work well with witch mythology. But then it's also sort of, there were these animal tales that were collected at the turn of the century, like associated with African-American literature and oral storytelling. And then there's like the real history of like enslaved people gaining illegal literacy. And so I like combined all that into a new fairy tale rather than trying to steal and remake one. We'll see how effective that was.
It's so good. Yeah. You're talking a little bit about, I love the kind of like alternate history that you've woven into that book. It's very sort of like feminist alternate history. I love it so much. I was reading it and I was like, wait a minute. It's like, I think the first thing I noticed was like Sisters Grimm instead of Brothers Grimm. And I was like, wait a minute. Wait, this is awesome. Yeah. Hold on.
Yeah. There's a part, because I got really obsessed with Circe, that book. Madeline Miller. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And then, of course, following that, got obsessed with Emily Wilson's new translation of the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. So there's a part where I get to like list some of the translators of the Odyssey, and I made them all women. Like, I changed all the names historically. And I was like, this is the most satisfying thing. Because one of the things I told myself early on, like in the early drafting of the book, it was a bummer. Like, the whole book was just really sad. And it's because I was reading too much real history about witches and suffragists who.
Yeah.
It's a bummer. Women's history is sad. And so like letting myself make a really alternate world and being like, wait, this is a world where witches at least at one point did exist, I think like it would be a little more chill. Like there would be cool stuff going on and women would have found more ways into the historical record. And that like freedom of writing that alternate history was very crucial to me.
Yeah, I loved it. It was like the more I was like unpacking it, I was like, oh, this is so great. It's like, I wish this was our real history. This is so good. So the fairy tales work so well. Why do you think they lend themselves so perfectly to like witching and spells and things like that? Like, it just is so perfect. Like at the beginning of each chapter, you have like these little pieces of fairy tales that are spells, and it's so perfect.
Yeah, I mean, those are like, I love the idea of like things hidden in plain sight. Like, I'm just such a sucker for that trope in fantasy.
Me too.
And the idea that like these seemingly insignificant bits of things like fairy tales and nursery rhymes that are associated with women and children mostly would actually be secretly powerful and cool. I mean, in some ways, that's like, I wrote my master's thesis on British children's literature and talking about like themes of imperialism and stuff in it. And in some ways it felt like a similar thing of like arguing that these things that just look like picture books that you guys don't think really matter and they're not where real history happened are actually like the sites of cultural creation. Like that's what we're teaching our children, and these words matter and these pictures matter. So it felt a little bit like I was drawing on that. And then the thing about fairy tales is that they're full of women. Like even the Western canon of fairy tales is full of women, and many of them act in very archetypal and tropey and gross ways, but not all of them. And there's a lot of room in those archetypes for like subversion, you know, like, so if you take like the maiden mother crone trio that is kind of obsessively repeated in Western mythologies, it's very easy to find that limiting and obnoxious, and it is, because it's basically defining women based on like what their reproductive state is, and that's left. But it's also kind of cool. There's like a lot of power in that idea of like womanhood, and I found it really fun to like look for those archetypes in fairy tales and imagine that maybe all the crones weren't the bad guys, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. Ah, awesome. So jumping over to 10,000 Doors of January for just a hot minute, if you stumbled across a door, capital D, where would you hope that it led if it could go? Because obviously they can go anywhere.
I mean, I think that we are recording in August of 2020, and I think any of us would go anywhere, literally right? Anywhere.
Literally anywhere.
I would
anywhere.
Go to a crowded Dollar Theater matinee right now, and I would be so happy. I would just be thrilled. I don't even care what the movie is. I would be pumped about it. But my real answer, like during normal times, would be, I think, Lyra's Oxford.
Oh,
or
good answer.
Earthsea, which is why I have like a wonderful seafaring culture of storytellers in my book, because I love Earthsea so much.
Oh, both good answers. Yes. Oh, Lyra's Oxford would be awesome.
No, I know it's terrible, and it's like a...
It is, but it's...
state, but also it seems pretty rad, and I want a daemon.
Yeah. I just really want a daemon.
I'll put up with a lot of fascism for a daemon. I would.
Right? Seriously. Oh, God, that's amazing. So, okay, so let's talk a little bit about kind of your writing process. What does that look like, if you have one? Because not all authors have a writing process.
Yeah, you had sent me these questions, some of them ahead of time, and I have written under that one in my notes. So I don't super have a writing process, I wouldn't say. I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and so I write when I can.
Super
my
valid.
My husband does most of the childcare, and he does all of the cooking and most of the cleaning. So I have it vastly easier than many people who are full-time caregivers and writers. But I still find my day is very fractured, my time very unreliable, particularly mm-hmm. during times when you can't really have, like, you know, outside childcare or leave the house or go right in the library. So my process right now is that, like, 3 days a week, I drive the Prius to the local utility building and I park outside of it in the shade and write.
That's, like, amazing.
Yeah. It's not fancy.
That's super valid. I was cracking up because I got a digital galley of Once and Future Witches and I only had access to it on my laptop. And my almost 3-year-old was like, no, no, I need the computer to watch my movies. And I was like, but I need to read, like, for work. And she was like, no, no, this is mine
now.
That's
not my concern. That's not my problem. Yeah.
Like, well, okay. I guess I'll eat in, like, teeny little chunks while you're taking a nap. Cool. So yeah, no, I get that. So you mentioned that you had a 1-year deadline for this book. How long does it usually take you to write a book? Like, how long did it take you to write 10,000 Doors versus the 1 year for this one?
So I was adjuncted, then I had a full-time staff job at a local university when I wrote 10,000 Doors, and I had my first kid in the middle of the draft. So I think it took like 4 years altogether, but there were a lot of interruptions during that. And Once and Future Witches, I wrote the first draft in a little under a year and then rewrote the whole book in another like 3 or 4 months. Yeah.
Nice. That's awesome. What has it been like publishing a book in 2020 in the middle of, you know, everything?
Yeah. I will say that it has been lucky that I'm not debuting in this year. Yes. I think that is so much harder for debut authors. And I don't know the statistics. I don't know the numbers of sales and stuff like that, but I know there's a lot of emotion with debuting and the feeling that your book is invisible and you don't know how it's doing, and being able to, like, go to actual bookstores and meet people and have actual events gives you the sense that your book is real and it exists.
Yeah.
And I have just a lot of sympathy for people who had to debut in a time where they're like, well, I saw it on Twitter. I hope it's real. Like, that would really suck.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, it's not a great time. I mean, it's not a great time for anything, but I guess I'm really grateful to have income that was already working from home.
Yeah.
And a virtual community of peers that was already online. So I guess I can't complain too much.
Yeah, my heart goes out to all the debut authors this year. I'm like, I want publishers to just email me all of the debut authors just so that I know, like,
I know
what's
I
new,
know.
Like, what I will support them. Like, what do I need to do?
It's always a weird competitive-y feeling of, like, who are the debuts who we're gonna know about in 2 years? And I hate that about it.
Yeah.
And it feels exaggerated this fall season because so many books got pushed from the summer to the fall. And it's rough times.
It's a weird time in publishing right now. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about like audiobooks and other things like that. So the audiobook of The 10,000 Doors of January, I'm obsessed with. It was so, so good. And I love that it was read by, it was January Lavoie, right? Like, that's the coolest. Yes. It was January, read by January. That's so cool. But so do you listen to audiobooks at all? Is that something you do?
I grew up listening to them. We were very much an audiobook household. Like, my little brothers listen to, I'm so sorry if they ever hear this, they probably won't, but they listen to the Harry Potter audiobooks like every night to go to sleep for years. Like, the way that I have those books in my brain is intense.
So cute.
I know, right?
That's so awesome.
It's fine. Boys, I love you. I'm sorry. But then I recently have kind of stopped, and partly that's because, like, I'm very picky about who's reading the book, and I have, like, Jim Dale's voice in my brain so deeply, so deeply. But I've listened to enough of them to know that January Lavoie is a genius, and I was very, very, very lucky to have her, and I'm so excited that she did 10,000 Doors. But mostly, I find it really my life is very interrupted right now. I don't have tons of time where I can listen to things, and there's definitely not going to be an interruption.
Yeah.
And I find that is fine with podcasts. I don't mind. But if I miss parts of my novel at the important bits, I lose my mind. So yep. I mostly don't do audiobooks.
I totally get that. Yeah. It was like pre-shutdown. Like I had an hour-long commute to the bookstore from where I live in the middle of the woods. And so I would crush audiobooks and just like that was like all I listened to in the car. And then everything shut down. And then I went on maternity leave and I was like, so when do I listen to audiobooks? Like, I was like, when do I do it? So I've had to literally like schedule myself time because I have, so we partner with Libro FM, who's really, really amazing for indie bookstores, and they give booksellers tons and tons and tons of free audiobooks every month so that we can like listen to them and talk them up. And so I have all of these books and I'm like, oh, I want to read that and that and that and that and that. When am I going to listen to these? Like I have to literally schedule time where I'm like, I'm going to go sit outside and put headphones in and like kind of keep an eye on my toddler while I listen to this book.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough. I miss my like drive. I should probably just be like, I'm going to go for a drive. Just drive around.
Which is funny because, you know, it feels like such an excessive use of time. Many things to me feel like, oh, I can't believe I'm spending time on this. That used to just be built into the normal fabric of my day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so crazy. Other than audiobooks, are you reading anything right now? Have you been able to cut through the brain fog of quarantine?
Yeah. I mean, I totally understand people who are like, I can't read a focus right now on novels. I totally get that. But I am a person who experiences stress and retreats to books. Like nice. That's always been the formula. So I've been reading so much. Haven't been sleeping like that much, but that's fine. I've read like almost all of Courtney Milan's romances in the last nice. Like week. So
amazing.
Yeah. I'm finding I have only like this year discovered romance as a genre because yeah, I really like the thing.
Same.
And I feel like a total fool. What was I doing?
What have I been reading all this time?
Yeah, like I've been reading fantasy books for the romances many times, yeah, often. And I don't know why it took me this long to be like, you know, there's an entire genre of that, right? Like they just are about the kissing. So that's been phenomenal. And I think I didn't fully realize that there's like so many subsections within romance and that you can literally just choose authors who are going to give you feminist comfort food. Like I didn't understand that. I kind of thought I would be wading through a lot of like obnoxious tropey stuff that like didn't meet my needs and discovering like Courtney Milan and Alyssa Cole is like, I get it.
Yep.
So yeah. I've been reading a lot of that. But I've also been reading a lot of arcs. So I just finished Lee Mandello's Summer Suns, which is coming out from tour next year. And it is so specifically, like I want to call it Kentucky Gothic.
Nice.
It's set in Nashville, but the author is Kentuckian. And it's just so good and smart. It's like idiot Southern boys with fast cars and like ghost stories. And yes, there's tense ex-lovers and there's a main character who at one point like halfway through the novel is like, oh, I'm not gay, and you're like, bud, you've been noticing men's collarbones for like 150 pages, what do you think you're doing?
And I love it.
I also read Emily Tesh's Silver in the Wood and Drowned Country, which are a pair of tour novellas that are like romances with the Green Man.
Nice.
Great. It's fantastic.
Oh my gosh.
And right now I'm reading Mykea Johnson's The Space Between Worlds, which just came out.
Amazing.
And I'm not very far into it, but the writing just on a craft level is stunning. I'm so excited about it.
Oh my gosh. I just added so many things to my mental list of hunt this down and read it. That's amazing. Do you have any recommendations for like a book that you just think everyone should read? Like, what are you recommending right now?
Ooh, what should everyone read? A lot of books. I'm talking about a lot of books because that's all I'm doing right now. What I just finished and what I obsessively, like, as I was reading it, recounted the entire plot to my poor husband was Such a Fun Age.
Yes.
Which is just so smart and observant. And this is a weird comparison, but like, it almost reminded me of like Austenish fiction because it was such a searing portrait and it was so socially observant, like these tiny little things that gave away people's entire political ideological selves. It was just, yeah, it was really good.
That's actually a really, really good way to describe it. I had never really thought about it that way, but you're right. It's, oh God, what a great book that was.
Yeah.
That was a book that like, I started it and I was like, oh, we're just jumping right in and this book's not going to let go of me.
It makes you sort of, like, it just feel like all my muscles were clenched the whole time I was reading it. Because it's like, I mean, the villain in the book is a white mom who spells her name Alex with an I and has two young children. So I was like, ooh, I feel called out by this. Oh no. Yeah. And she's like embarrassing on a number of levels, and which told me that it's very well written and very observant.
Yeah. Oh God, that's a phenomenal book. We're almost wrapping up here. I'm curious if there's something that you would love for readers to take away from your books, what would it be?
It's hard to say because I do everything I write is a little bit different and it's hard to say what I would want them to take away. But I guess the reason I kind of got back into writing is basically like a sense of wonder. Like, and I know that that's very cheesy, but I was in grad school and I was kind of sad and anxious because I was in grad school and I checked out Le Guin's Earthsea books for the first time since I was a kid and read them all. And it just felt so much like that's what I had forgotten in academia a little bit, the sense of like horizons and dragons. Yes, absolutely dragons. And like the sense of just wonder and possibility. And I wish that that is what people would feel when they read my works. It would be the coolest thing.
I love that. Well, I can tell you, at least for me and also my husband, you're nailing it. I was, I was like completely obsessed with 10,000 Doors when that came out. Which, you know, of course, when Erin Morgenstern herself is like, hey, read this book, you're going to be like, okay, I'm going to read this book. And then I read it and I couldn't stop talking about it. And my poor listeners have heard me gush about your book.
I'm so sorry.
When I get fixated on a book, it's all I talk about. And my husband finally just picked it up and because he was like, oh, you're interviewing Alex. That's really cool. I want to read 10,000 Doors. And like, I watch him, like he sits down all casual. All right, I'm going to read a book. He sits down and I just like watch his eyes like laser focus into your book. Like the whole rest of the world just like goes away. It's so cute to watch him just like dive into, and he'll like stop after a couple of chapters and just like look around like where am I. He's like, are you kidding me? I'm like, I know.
It's can so I just cute. Say like a side note, shout out to Erin Morgenstern because we both had books come out within like I think a month of each other that were very much like, let's talk about portal fantasies and magic doors. We have a lot of feelings about that, and instead of being like, who's this debut coming up here writing about magic tours at the time, I'm trying to do it better, she was just like, oh yeah, I'll promote that book, I love that, that was fun. And I just, that's fantastic. Thank
right
you.
I love that she was like, oh, they're like kin, they're like cousin books. Yeah. I was like, oh my heart. And it was one of those things where I don't know, like I was gonna pick up your book anyway because the cover like just like threw itself at me. I was like, oh my God, this is cool, like what is this? It came out, you know, on, I was doing the laydowns on Tuesday and I was like, what is this?
I know, they made it so pretty. That was Lisa Marie Pompilio, who is Orbit's designer, and she's phenomenal. She did Once and Future Witches too.
Oh, good. Yeah. And so like, I was going to read it regardless. And then like, Erin was like, oh, have you read this? And I was like, I mean, not yet. She was like, oh, it's really good. She's like, I just finished it. It's really good. I was like, okay. Yeah, no, so awesome. Yeah, what an awesome like boost for your book to be like, if you like this, you'll like this. You touched on this a little bit, but can you talk about what's next, what you're working on right now?
Yeah, so I have it's going to eventually be two, but there's the first one is the other one that's written, toward.com novellas that are like, the pitch was Spider-versing fairy tales, where I got to have like multi-dimensional fairy tales happenings. And then the next novel length thing I'm working on hasn't been announced, so I can't say that much, but I will say that it is fully diving into my Southern Gothic heart. Like, nice. I'm just going for that. Mixed with maybe a little bit of Beauty and the Beast. So, cool. You know, yeah.
Awesome. Oh my God, I'm so excited. I can't wait. fantastic. I think that's all I've got for you. Alex, thank you so much for hanging out and chatting with me. This was awesome.
Thank you so much for having me. This was wonderful. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing during these hard times to promote books.
Thanks. Awesome. All right. Hang in there. Have a great day.
You too.
Thanks again to Alex E. Harrow for taking the time to chat with me. The 10,000 Doors of January is on our shelves now, and The Once and Future Witches is available for pre-order and will be coming out on October 13th. A reminder about our partnership with Libro FM. Our listeners who are new to Libro FM can receive 3 digital audiobooks for the price of 1 credit by using the code LAYDOWN at checkout when they start a new membership. It's a fantastic deal that you should absolutely take advantage of. You can email us about the podcast at thelaydownpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gibsonsbookstore.com, and we're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and we'll put those links in the show notes along with all of the books that were mentioned during this episode. Thank you all so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll know when we upload our next episode, and consider leaving us a nice review. Until next time, we'll see you in the stacks. Bye!